Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones. From powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY. A big idea that inspired the world to invest differently. And still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
This is Squawk Pod. I'm CNBC producer Katie Kramer. On our podcast today, Paul Tudor Jones.
We've got to be careful not to mythologize this into the pandemic Godzilla, because we can beat this thing. We're going to squash it and send it back to the oblivion that it crawled out of.
The hedge fund titan and philanthropist was the first money manager to tell CNBC that he was concerned about the coronavirus back in January. Today, how he feels about his future telling abilities.
What a damn mess.
Contending with the unprecedented shock of a pandemic to the economy.
Investors can take heart that we've counteracted this existential shock with the greatest fiscal monetary bazooka. It's not even a bazooka. It's more like a nuclear bomb.
And the rocky road ahead.
I'm much more nervous about the loss of life that could come with a 15 or 20% unemployment rate than I am about the loss of life that comes with CV-19.
It's Thursday, March 26th, 2020. Squawk Pod begins right after this.
What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration, our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
This is Squawk Pod from CNBC. COVID-19 has upended the U.S. economy and our lives. Last week, over 3 million Americans filed for unemployment. That's the largest number in such a short time, at least as long as the Labor Department records go back, which is to the 1960s. This record-shattering number is the first indication of how hard the labor force is being hit by the pandemic. To mitigate some of the pressure on Americans, the Senate passed a $2 trillion economic relief package that is now heading to the House, which hopes to approve it by Friday. And all the while, cases of coronavirus around the world continue to rise. The death tolls in Italy and in Spain have now surpassed China's, and new cases in New York are escalating. The virus's death toll is awful to contemplate, but what could also be pretty frightening, the loss of life we could see from a spike in unemployment. That is according to Paul Tudor Jones, a hedge fund titan, and our highlight interview today on the pod. Paul Tudor Jones is the founder and chief investment officer of Tudor Investment Corporation, the chairman of Just Capital, and the founder of the nonprofit Robinhood, which serves New York City's homeless population. Jones was also the first guest on Squawk Box to say he was worried about the coronavirus on January 21st of this year at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland.
There's no antidote. There's no vaccination.
Can't do it.
There's no cure. We don't even know what the incubation period is.
Right.
And you're obviously getting ready to go to the biggest travel period in China.
So are you seeing through this or not? Right. I mean, on a morning like today, when David Tepper on Friday...
I'm a trader, not an investor.
Correct.
So if I was an investor, I'd be really nervous.
Since those comments just 2 months ago, the S&P has fallen 25%. Paul Tudor Jones joined us via Skype today on Squawk Box with Andrew Ross Sorkin, Joe Kernan, and Becky Quick. Here's Andrew.
Paul, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Andrew. What a damn mess.
What a mess. Tell us about it. You've been thinking about this, I think, literally since we spoke with you back in January. You also wrote a letter to your investors in February calling this right again. So understanding where your head is at right now, where the market is at, and where this is all headed is very important. How do you see it?
Well, I think COVID-19 is, it's unlike anything we've obviously ever seen before. If we kind of think about where we are right now, we're probably, if you look at the Hubei experience, and we extrapolate from that what is getting ready to happen in the United States, to New York in particular, we're probably going to hit our peak somewhere between April 4th and April 10th. My guess is we could have somewhere between 300,000 and 400,000 cases in the United States. It's going to be a really challenging period, I think, for us as Americans, because certainly in New York City, our healthcare system is going to get overwhelmed, and it's going to be something that I think all of us have to steel ourselves for. There's a really high probability it's going to come. I don't think we need to panic. I look at this like when I used to box. I remember I never got knocked down in my life, but having seen many people get knocked down, you learn something from that in your next fight. And I think what we're going to do is we're going to see the worst of COVID-19. It's going to throw its best punch over the course of the next, say, somewhere in the next 2 weeks. And then we're going to be on the backside of that. And the good news, the great news, is that in Hubei, from the peak, it was 24 days from the peak to where they went back down to under 100 cases a day. So we've got to remember, there is light on the other side of this. We're going to get through it. It's going to be something that unfortunately probably didn't have to happen, but has happened. Let's not think about what could have been. Let's think about where we're going to be and what we're going to do on the other side.
Paul, explain this. So you're using Hubei numbers to extrapolate out and model out. And I would tell you, by the way, I love your optimism. I hope you're right. One of the questions, though, is whether this starts to roll across the country. Meaning, you know, the measures that were taken in China really did quarantine the situation in Hubei for the most part. We have not had a national lockdown. We're starting to see hotspots emerge in other places like New Orleans, in Atlanta, elsewhere. You know, New York may have its own curve, and hopefully we will get to the other side of that in a couple of weeks. But there may be new curves that emerge. And so how do you think about that as part of that timeline? Or are you convinced that this is been locked down now?
So clearly everything that you say is 100% correct. I'm looking at Italy because I think Italy is going to be the analog for us. Hubei, they had in Hubei command and control, right? If you think about China, it's a surveillance economy. Everyone has an ID. Every phone can be tracked. If you think about the preventive measures they took, maybe on a scale of 1 to 10, they're a 10. And maybe where we're going to go in a free society is going to be something like a 5. So whereas they had railroad tracks, if you look at their epidemic curve, they had vertical railroad tracks. We're going to probably have more like a hill. And we're going to have a fatter right tail. And again, I would look at Italy for us as the guide as to what we can expect. And then clearly we're learning as we go through this, right? If we go back to China, people who were food preparers, I was in a McDonald's yesterday and they're serving food without masks, without gloves. In China, all food preparers at fast food were wearing masks, wearing gloves. They were taking your temperature on the streets. They were taking your temperature in restaurants. It's going to be interesting to see how our society responds to the pain and suffering that we're going to witness over the course of the next 2 weeks as we get to the peak of the epidemic curve. Having said all that, and listen, my heart goes out to the people that are going to be our first responders. My heart goes out to the people that are going to be affected. My own daughter has CV-19 right now. She's recovering from it. She had a mild case, gratefully. We're so blessed. At 25 years old, 26 years old, she had nothing more than a mild case, she and her fiance. So I've seen firsthand what you have to do to self-quarantine. I've seen firsthand the impacts that I've had on them. And I get nervous. And something as we go through these, and again, I think the next 2 weeks are going to be the most challenging for us from an emotional and psychological standpoint, because we're going to see this curve and the new cases escalate every day. But we've also got to be careful not to mythologize this particular disease. Let's assume a worst case scenario, a worst case scenario. Let's assume a million cases, which is 2.5 times what I think we're going to have. And let's assume a mortality rate. And again, forgive me for speaking with such morbidity, but let's assume a fatality rate of 4%, mortality rate of 4%, like what we're seeing globally. So 40,000 Americans sadly and tragically will die. That still is the equivalent of what we see during the flu season. So we've got to be careful not to mythologize this into the pandemic Godzilla, because we can beat this thing. America can beat this thing. Humanity can beat this thing. And we're going to squash it and send it back to the oblivion that it crawled out of. I have zero doubt in my mind on that. We've got to be calm. We got to stay rational, not panic over the next 2 weeks.
Hey, Paul, first of all, I'm so sorry to hear about your daughter, although relieved
She's
to hear
fine.
That it's a mild
She's
case.
Great. She's so. Been working.
Yeah,
she worked every single day remotely while she had it.
Wow.
So, again, there's for the large portion of the population, this is not going to be a life-threatening or it's going to be life-changing, but not a life-threatening thing for a large portion of the population.
I realize you've done the numbers and kind of worked this out, and that doesn't sound like it's unreasonable to think 4% mortality. That's probably higher than a lot of people think we're really going to see in terms of mortality cases.
I think will be much less. I'm saying in a worst case
basis.
Yeah,
I think it'll be much less, too.
I think on social media and the media, we've got to realize we're prone to hype things beyond what they are. And we have to all remember.
I understand that entirely. And I just want to talk through a little bit what we hear from doctors pretty frequently, including Dr. Scott Gottlieb, even though he thinks, too, you'll come out the other side. You're talking 8 to 10 weeks on something like this. The concern doctors have is trying to flatten that curve right now so that it is less overwhelming on the healthcare systems like New York City. You go along with that. I understand everything you're saying. But there are some people who hear what you're saying and then think, as a result, it should be business as usual and these states should not be doing lockdowns. Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm saying we have to be extraordinarily vigilant and implement and practice extreme safety measures until we get on the other side of the epidemic curve and see it in a free fall. There's no question that's what we have to do. I think, and my guess is that's going to be sometime in late April, early May. That would be optimistic. That would be following the Hubei example. And again, if you just think about this, we've got these incredible experiments going on country by country. Some of it, China, command and control, Singapore, command and control, Hong Kong, command and control. They did a great job. We've got free societies in Europe, in the United States, that are going to experience much different outcomes. And then tragically, we've got less developed countries like in Africa, who I worry about the most, with the most vulnerable populations, who are not going to be able, I think, to get even as far as many free societies in Western Europe as well as the United States. And those are the ones that I worry about the most. But where we'll end up, say, 3, 4, 5 months from now, is we'll have these beta tests of various degrees of intervention by public authorities, various degrees of onboarding by private citizens of the protocols that it takes to actually stop this. And then we'll also have a real-time GDP experiment to understand the impacts it has on the economies. And we'll know so much more in 3 or 4 months. And I think we'll be prepared. You know, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. We'll be so much better prepared this fall to be able to deal with this, and I think to get back to business as usual and to resume the way our lives were but 3 months ago. And I think we'll learn again tragically a lot about herd immunity because we're going to see that, right, unfortunately, practice real time in some less developed countries.
Hey, Paul, you know, you were right on the money in January to tell us that if you were an investor, you would be nervous, you would be risk off. Given where we are right now, in terms of the curve that you've now talked about and where the stock market is right now, if you were an investor, what would you be doing?
I think what we're going to see is let's just first of all, let's frame what's happened from a monetary and fiscal stance. So from a fiscal stance, we have a fiscal package of 10% of GDP. That's double what we got in October of 2008, double. Now, they came with another package in March of 2009 that got us up to 10%. And my guess is we'll be back with a bigger fiscal package somewhere down the road. From a monetary standpoint, we've already, and by the end of this week, we'll have bought $1 trillion worth of treasuries and mortgage backs. We did in 2 weeks what it took the Fed 8 months to do in 2009. Remember, we didn't even get quantitative easing until well after the great financial crisis had started, well into the recession. Here, we've got $1 trillion in 2 weeks. By May, we will have already, at this rate, already have purchased what took us 6 years to do in the great financial crisis. So investors can take heart that we've counteracted this existential shock with the greatest fiscal monetary bazooka. It's not even a bazooka. It's more like a nuclear bomb. That's literally the countermeasures that we brought in to sit there and to bring safety to our economic system. So I think some combination of those two will buy us time. As Chairman Powell said this morning, it's the bridge to the future. Now, what happens? So my guess is one of the reasons the market's up right now is because of all the month-end rebalancing that the market's front-running. It sees the fact that there are going to be a lot of equities to buy. And that's one reason. My guess is we'll stay firm into month-end. And then we're going to be challenged in April. We're going to be challenged as we go through the epicenter, the peak of the epidemic curve. So I think that could bring us to a retest. It might even bring us to a fractional new low. But I do think the stock market's going to find a bottom. Once we get the peak in the epidemic curve, no doubt in my mind, the stock market will rally, and it should rally. And my guess is we'll be higher 3 or 4 months from now, 5 months from now, than lower than where we are right now. What happens after that is highly dependent upon our ability to get back to work, our ability to resume normal functioning. And it's really interesting. You've got this dynamic tension. You've got people such as myself in the economic field thinking about getting back to work, thinking about resuming normal activity. You've got people in the medical profession who can only see the problems that they're dealing with. And my God, again, my heart goes out to them because they're dealing with these huge problems. But I can tell you from an economic standpoint, the risk that we have, if we don't, again, each of us individually begin to think about how we're going to get back to work, how we're going to deal with the new normal. If we don't begin today, not get paralyzed by the next 2 weeks and think about how we're going to resume a normal life on the back end of this epidemic curve, we're all making a big mistake. So we've got to look through these numbers, look through the tragedy the next 2 weeks, think about how we're going to restart our lives, think about how we're going to deal with the new normal, and think about how we're going to restart America. The thing that I'm nervous about, and one reason why I keep pushing this theme so much, is that I think people give our economy too much credit for its resilience. If I just look at the biggest thing that I'm worried about for the long run is that we have a huge, enormous debt buildup over the past 4 decades to levels that we've never seen before in the history of this country. So debt to GDP going into the 2000 NASDAQ top was 180%. In 2007, it was 225%. And at the end of this year, we're going to be 270%. So it makes me really nervous. The resiliency, the possibility of a V bottom, we have impediments to that. We have structural impediments to it, which is the amount of debt that we have. So I think we're going to have to think smart, and we're going to have to begin now to think about how are we going to restart our businesses and do it living with CB19. And we may have to live with something that's going to be, again, an impairment to our society, but it doesn't have to be the end of our society. So I don't know if we'll eradicate it. I do know that if we have great testing, if we can have just in a few months' time, 3, 4, 5 months' time, if we have testing so that we can identify and begin contact tracing individually, and as a society, if we embrace that, then we can live with CB19. We can live with people being out of work for a period of time, self-isolated, quarantined, and get back to things as normal. I think that's what we've got to do. I'm most hopeful,
Paul,
for the testing thing.
Paul, you're a trader, obviously, but you're also a human being, and you talked about your family and things like that. When you were most, I don't know whether you would call it despair, but at your moment of peak worry about this, did you ever think in numbers of millions dying in the United States? Was that a possibility at some point? And is it still a possibility that it could get to that point? Or did you never really? Did you?
Zero chance. Please, we are too smart. We're too smart as a people. We're too resilient. I think when this is all over and said and done, we're gonna look at death rates very similar to the flu, because we're gonna take the precautions that are necessary to keep us from suffering from that type of mortality rate from CB19. What I'm worried about, and I'll be really honest, what I'm worried about is if again, our economy is, oh my Lord, we had a 40-50 year buildup of a globally interconnected, globally leveraged, highly sophisticated, fine-tuned economy built on global trust, built on individual trust, institutions with huge amounts of cross-connectivity. So now all of a sudden we've got this, again, this event that has stopped all that. We're closing borders. We're going insular. And so I'm more nervous about what happens if we have something that's between the Great Depression and the Great Financial Crisis. What are the human impacts of that? I'm much more nervous about the loss of life that could come with a 15 or 20% unemployment rate than I am about the loss of life that comes with CB19. CB19 may cost us, let's say CB19 again, I think we're going to peak out somewhere in the 300,000 to 400,000 range. And if I use an overly pessimistic view of 4% mortality rate, because our healthcare system will be overwhelmed in the next 2 weeks, we're talking 16,000 people. In the Great Depression, there was a study that was out, a 10 point rise in unemployment rate could have as many as 200,000 fatalities associated with it, from health impairment, suicides, opioid use, drug use, et cetera. So I'm thinking about, and again, as someone in the economic world, I understand the necessity and the need for us to deal with CB19, but I don't think that's our biggest threat. Our biggest threat is what happens to the economy on the other side. And that's why I think each of us has to think, how are we going to restart our business? What do we need to do to make people safe, feel safe, to interact again in business? Wearing masks, right. Wearing masks, wearing gloves, wiping down. And I think as American people, we're fastidious, and we'll do, as a human race, we're going to do this. We're going to kick this bug's ass. And we've got to think about how we're going to resume our normal lives.
Hey, Paul, we want to thank you for joining us. But before we let you go, I know you're doing a lot of work with Robinhood in New York, which is going to be the epicenter of this, at least in the near term. What are you working on with the Robinhood program in New York right now?
Well, we had our benefits scheduled a year ago for May 11th at the Javits Center. The Javits Center is now a hospital, but we're going to have our benefit. It's going to be a virtual benefit. It's going to be on May 11th. We're going to broadcast from a variety of locations. Instead of serving, having 4,000 people, we're going to hopefully have this televised, and we're going to have whether it's 400,000 or 4 million. New York City is the epicenter. And this bill that was just passed that, you know, if you listen to Pelosi, Schumer, Trump, workers, 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 and God forbid, we're going to need help for American workers. They deserve it. But there's a, again, there wasn't that much in there for the most destitute and the most poor. And so, yes, we've got relief for workers, but in New York, which is the most number of people in poverty, 1.8 million, there's a lot of undocumented workers. There are people who've been out of work for more than a month that will not be eligible for these checks. I can tell you food pantries have already seen a 50% spike in people going. We've lost our volunteers because people are afraid to go out in a variety of our organizations. This is the most important time for people to help the most poor because they're the ones that are going to suffer the most. Imagine all the kids in shelter who don't have the ability to get an education because they don't have online access. They don't have computers. There's so much that we've got to do, and we're going to do it on May 11th. So tune in because it's going to be a great night. It's going to be an uplifting night. It's going to be like our 9/11 relief fund that we had back in 9/11. I'll never forget. We were all so scared after the Twin Towers came down. And then we had the anthrax scare. We were scared to even put that event on. And I remember at that event, we had our first responders. And on introducing the WHO, this fireman came up and he had lost his brother in 9/11. He said, "Osama bin Laden, you can kiss my royal fat Irish ass." And the place went nuts. That moment, that was the moment that America began to fight back. So I'm hoping May 11th will be one of those beautiful moments where we'll be on the backside of the epidemic curve. We'll do it virtually, and we'll show you can continue life, but in a new way. And we're going to continue business as usual, and we're going to help the people who need it the most. And it's going to be a great night. So more details on that will come back. And again, I'm optimistic. This brings out the best in us, these crises do. 2008 and the great financial crisis, Robin Hood raised more money than it ever has. So I'm really optimistic about the future. I know we'll beat this thing, and I look forward to doing my small part in it, like each of us is going to.
Paul Tudor Jones, it's a privilege to spend time with you. Thank you for spending the last half hour with us.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, packageless and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. FedEx Ground service is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
At Capella University, you'll get support from people who care about your success. From before you enroll to after you graduate, pursue your goals knowing help is available when you need it. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.
That's Squawk Pod for today. Thanks for listening to this podcast. Squawk Box is hosted by Joe Kernan, Becky Quick, and Andrew Ross Sorkin. Tune in weekday mornings on CNBC at 6 a.m. Eastern. To get the smartest takes and analysis from our TV show right into your ears, subscribe to Squawk Pod. We are on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, wherever you listen. And hey, tell a friend to subscribe too. We'll meet you back here tomorrow.
It's sometimes it takes a different approach to help you unlock your true potential. With Capella University's game-changing FlexPath learning format, you gain relevant skills you can apply to your career right away. Earn your degree from an accredited university and be confident in the quality of your education. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu. Capella University is accredited by the Higher Learning Commission. Learn more at capella.edu/accreditation.